Good morning. Welcome. I just first of all, welcome everybody. This next series we're going to be learning. We have a summit to learn together, and we're going to be learning about the topic, what's called positively Jewish, about positive Judaism, a lot of psychology and Torah together. And I want to first of all start by thanking the Leichtons and the Schachters for sponsoring this morning's shiur. Uli Nishmas, Aliza's sister, Mindy Greenberg, Aleha Hashalom, Nachama Mindel, Bas Yitzhak Aryeh, Aleha Hashalom, but also her parents, Leo and Shirley Schachter. God willing, there should be an aliyas neshama, and the family should continue to grow with sinasmacha, simetz Hashem, with no tircha, and this should be a continued aliyas neshama for Nechama Mindel. Let's start and learn together. So this is a very fascinating topic, if you don't mind me saying so myself. And I've spent a lot of time thinking and spending time and considering this. I want to start off, it starts off actually a little while back. It starts off in 1861, in a famous speech, the inaugural address given by the 16th President of the United States on March 4th. As you can see, it was a packed gathering. It wasn't just the coffee either there. At the closing moments of his address, this is what he says: "We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic chords of memory will swell when again touched, as surely they will be by the better angels of our nature." What is Abraham Lincoln trying to say in his last words in the inaugural address?
He's trying to stop the Civil War.
He's trying, to the best he can, to stop the Civil War. At this point in time, he has walked into an almost impossible situation in America, with the South trying to secede from the Union. At this point in time, he's really appealing to everybody, let's just calm down, let's just relax, and let's try to make peace, right? So, and of course, he's not able to succeed at this point in time. It's way too late for this to have worked. That was in the previous years, the abolitionists, and the previous president. There were a lot of other things that could have been done, weren't done up to this point in time. What is fascinating about his address is the following, is that the way he addresses the people is, what should catalyze, what should actualize, we'll call it peace or letting go, is he is speaking to the better angels of our nature, which is a very fascinating idea, which means to say that he's speaking to what we call in psychology the character ethic. He's saying that people are good. There's a natural innate goodness in a human being, and he's appealing to that, and he's saying, addressing that better angel of our nature, listen to that rather than the negative angel of our nature, right? Meaning, so there's bad parts of our nature, the good parts of our nature. Somehow, listen to overcome the jealousy, overcome the territorialness, all those things. Try to listen to the good things in yourselves. And this, in fact, was the predominant idea in psychology, which is certainly in Victorian times. We're talking about the notion that people are good. People have a certain innate goodness or innate badness, and we can move towards one or the other. However, things changed a little bit, and this is one moment. This is what one of the moments that's pointed to. It's not necessarily the only moment, and certainly a moment only on this side of the Atlantic. But the Haymarket, the Haymarket Square affair. So, for those who go to train museums, you'll see there's a lot about this as well. This was Haymarket Square, of course, is in Chicago. And what happened was, in a demonstration, a workers' demonstration, nobody really knows who, threw a bomb at the police, and the police had a violent reprisal. There were a number of protesters who were killed. And what happened was, you see, up till now, people looked at psychology and they said, well, if your person's doing something bad, it must mean that it's coming out of bad character, out of choices they made in their lives. If a person's doing something good enough, the better angels of their character are expressing that. But now what happened was that certain theologians and philosophers started saying, well, you know what? What is interesting is that when we're seeing the civil unrest, this is a decade after the Civil War, 1886, when we start seeing the civil unrest unfolding, we notice something, that all of the people who were, in fact, involved all came from a lower income class in society. Most of them couldn't speak English. A lot of them lived in one-family bedrooms and were not able to put bread on the table. Maybe something about their environment actually impacted the way they acted more than necessarily their character. You see, this was the question that started emerging now. And this started branching into different disciplines. So now what happened was the birth of social science was arrived. And in the universities now, the teaching started shifting and saying, maybe if there's a problem, If there's evil going on, if there are riots going on, maybe it's not a factor of bad people, but maybe it's a factor of bad society or bad conditions. So if there's a problem where people are acting in an uneducated way, the solution isn't to blame them for being uneducated, but to educate them. And if people are going, resolving or ending up with juvenile delinquency, then the solution is to address those kids, to address the inner city urban issues that are starting to rise already at this time. So this became a move in the social sciences, and you see a lot of the thinkers already at the end of the turn of the century and moving towards this 20th century started thinking in what we'll call environmental psychology, or the environment, the impact, rather than the character. Character got left behind with the Victorian era, and character was no longer deemed a worthy. It was almost like a toxic word as to what makes the person tick or not. It's really primarily the environment. So, you know, when you're looking out into, you know, Darwin and Freud, these writings actually heavily impact this. Maybe it isn't so much a factor of who we are, but rather the environment, our natural selection, our inner conflicts, the things that are going on in our lives, which are therefore affecting and impacting us. And if we can affect those, if we can change those environments, then maybe perhaps we can change the character. And there was this large shift in ultimately character ethic, which was this earlier notion, sort of disappeared. It remained somewhat on the sidelines of psychology in what was called personality. So it was slipped in by the back door as was personality, without the baggage of the pre-existing notion of character ethic, until pretty recently. Pretty recently, the environmental notion of a person's formation has been, in fact, rejected to a large degree today for a number of reasons. Again, it's a matter of much of a debate, nature and nurture, and it seems to be certainly there's a large amount of both. But to a large degree, we're seeing that in the environmental forming of a human being is not necessarily fully true for a very simple reason. Number one is that there seems to be certain things which are hereditary, meaning there's certain characteristics which seem to run in families. That means that you can't account for it simply being in the environment. There's certain things that people are more inclined to than other things, which means to say that there is a sort of starting point in terms of language, in terms of even just imagery, or things that people are used to. It isn't simply a function of what you are brought up with. There's certain innate qualities that people feel. So there's been this shift back to what we call personality psychology, which has been in the last few years. And leading the charge in this area is a person called Dr. Martin Seligman, who was the head of the APA, the American Psychological Association, about 20 years ago. Actually, just more recently, about 15, 20 years ago. And He started working in the following field. He's famous for his breakthrough was about learned helplessness, which was a number of years ago. Experiments on dogs about the notion that you can actually create, you can ingrain some pessimism or optimism or helplessness based on experience. Very fascinating researcher, and he currently is one of the leading professors at Penn, and has a lot of very, very interesting things to say. I want to just focus on one of them, and that is that he described the following problem. He says, so what happened was is when he became one of the leading figures in psychology in America, a number of foundations turned to him and said, let's try to invest in not so much dealing with issues, dealing with problems. Psychology has been dealing with lots of problems for the last century, the conditions, various we'll call it diseases, chemically or psychologically, and we've actually been pretty successful. Generally speaking, of the 14 major conditions, two have actually been resolved or are resolvable, the other 12 addressable, and psychology has been able to address a lot of issues. But the problem is, in general, what psychology or psychiatry, for that matter, has been able to do is moving a person from a -6 to a -2, right? I mean, you say we're moving people from greatly diseased situations and stations in life to less diseased stations in life. But psychology hasn't been focusing on saying, can we move people from a 0 to a 3 or a 2 to a 7? Can we move a person from a lifestyle where it's neutral to a situation where actually maybe I can be enjoying life, I can be having flow, fulfillment, happiness? But psychology hasn't had the time to deal with that because they've been dealing with the issues. So psychology started moving to under his leadership towards, let's try to understand this. But the problem is that all these foundations come to him, and they had a conference in which they had, I believe, 41 different organizations presenting different interventions on the education system to say, what should we do to our kids? What should we teach them? What interventions should we institute in the school system that perhaps might allow them to create to live happier lives? And there were obviously very, very bold and very, very creative suggestions made by very dynamic presenters. But at the end of the conference, you know, the leader of the conference said, it doesn't make sense. We don't know what we're trying to do. Meaning, what are we trying? You know, this organization says, you know, we're going to, you know, address self-esteem in the classroom. But what is self-esteem? Meaning, say, it's almost like you're starting from nowhere. There's no playing field. There's no goals as to where we're supposed to be running towards. So who decides what intervention is successful? So what they decided to do was they decided, well, let's try to congregate, let's try to classify what it is that we're trying to achieve in advancing human psychology. So the example he gives is the following. When he was a younger psychologist, he was at a particular conference, an international conference, where they were trying to deal with some particular diseases, and they gave an example where there was a particular lady, Nebach, who every time she went to the restroom, she would look at the bottom of the toilet bowl. Why? Because she was concerned that she miscarried a fetus into the toilet bowl every single time she went to the bathroom. And they got up and they gave all the psychiatrists and psychologists, what do you diagnose? So he gets up and he says, that's schizophrenia. And all the English psychologists start snickering, and they say that's clearly obsessive compulsive. Which means to say that not so long ago, it wasn't even clear across the world as to what could disease or what condition we're dealing with, because every country had its own standards, which led to the creation of what's called DSM-3, and of course we're up to 5 at this point in time, where let's try to say, what does everybody agree with? What are the conditions and how do we deal with them? So they said, let's do the same thing for positive psychology. Let's say instead of everybody talking about something and I talk about happiness and you talk about happiness and we mean absolutely different things, let's try to see what does that actually mean. But the problem is the following. How do you do that? Because, as an example, what's virtuous in American society today is very different to what is virtuous in the times of Aristotle, as an example. Right? So, just to give an example, this is one of his books, Dr. Seligman's book, it's called Authentic Happiness. So, you know, as an example, in today's society, in today's society, we value self-esteem, good looks, assertiveness, autonomy, uniqueness, wealth, and competitiveness. These are the things which, in society today, we put a lot of value on. But reverse a few hundred years, and some of the values are quite different. Chastity, silence, magnificence, vengeance. These are very different sets of values which society prided itself in. So how do you start and say, well, where is the starting point for our value system? Where do we start saying, well, these are good characteristics, these aren't, so now we can start moving towards it. So what happened was he hired a fellow called Christopher Peterson, who was the head of psychology at Michigan State University, and he said, so I want you to take three years off your career, and I want you to do this. I want you to create a system and a structure of character strengths. So, and this is not about like, you know, sitting there and writing a self-help book about what you feel is, you know, going to be the sequel to Serenity. We're talking about let's try to measure throughout all culture and throughout all history, laterally and in depth. What did cultures value? What are the basics that cultures valued? So what ultimately they came after 3 years of research and reading, all the basics of every culture, based from Judaism to Christianity to Islam, what ended up happening was, so right, here we go, this is just a background over here, this is the Authentic Happiness, which is one of the beautiful books. He talks about the research that he did, but actually in 2004, this is called Character Strengths and Virtues. Essentially it's a textbook for character strengths, very hard to get hold of. And ultimately, the movement that he developed was the following. When you're looking at all the different cultures of the past, he ultimately came out with a system of six, what he calls ubiquitous virtues. Six ubiquitous virtues, which are wisdom, courage, humanity, justice, temperance, and transcendence. Those are things that aren't universal, because not every culture agrees with it, but ubiquitous means to say that most cultures value most of them. That means to say that, in general, these are things which all the cultures have valued. And this is the starting point, what he calls the six virtues, become the starting point for, well, let's say, well, how does everything else fit into that? The next step was to say, well, let's try to find the routes towards these. So they subdivided these into 24 what we call strengths. Okay, so these are called this is the virtues in action, VIA, virtues in action, 24 character strengths, in which each is a silo for these different ideas. So for instance, under wisdom is creativity, curiosity, judgment, love of learning, and perspective. What makes a character strength is something which is agreed upon, and, agreed upon that it's not a relative term. Meaning to say, when you talk about creativity is good, because creativity is good. It's not that creativity is good depending on where. Creativity is good. Under humanity, love, kindness, social intelligence. These are different strengths which lead to these notions, these virtues. A lot of time was spent in this, and a lot of measurement, and a lot of analysis, and a lot of surveys were taken in order to get to this point. In fact, if you want to take a look at some of the surveys they set up, we have tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people taken, and then you go to AuthenticHappiness.com, which is the UPenn, it's his website in which he does a lot of this research. Based on a lot of the research, based on a lot of the historical research, this is the system that was around at. This is a very fascinating section. What I would highly advise, if anybody's interested, is go to the authentichappiness.sas.upenn.edu and go and look at some of the tests there. And I would suggest that everybody takes a moment for themselves to do the VIA character strength test. It essentially is 240 questions, and each page is 24 questions 10 times over. And it's the same 24 questions, essentially, in different ways, because there's 24 strengths. And it asks you in an honest way, what do you feel in a certain situation? How would you react to this? How would you think about that? And as you go over that 10 times, you get a certain sense of your measuring in each of the character strengths, and you have a personal portfolio on this website, and it lets you know what your five top strengths are, your lowest five strengths, that generally means weaknesses. And it's very helpful. By the way, everything that you do over here is, of course, incorporated into the system of the research as well, because every test you take, of course, is part of the greater wealth of research. Just so you should be aware of how sophisticated this is. He's been hired recently in the last 5 years by the American Army to do research on well-being in soldiers, because obviously the performance of soldiers in the field depends on their wellness and their ability to be able to do PTG, post-traumatic growth, as opposed to post-traumatic stress disorder, which costs billions of dollars to this country, is impacted in how we train our soldiers. So you should be aware of that. Which means that he has a database of surveys starting in the last years of 1.2 million people. So there's a lot of research which has gone into this. Very, very fascinating as to how to educate these different values and how to measure them against each other, which is a remarkable advent, and we should be proud that we're living at a time where this is possible. Now, so this is just a very brief overview of it, and I really highly recommend you take a look at the videos, you take a look at the research, and do this if you have the opportunity to do this as a shidduch with your spouse. It's wonderful. It takes about 20 minutes, I would say. Take 20 minutes by each person by themselves, and then come back afterwards and sort of discuss. It's very fascinating to understand other people. It's an amazing, amazing experience, and there's a lot to learn. Now, the question is this wasn't a shiur on Dr. Seligman. It wasn't supposed to be. So let's talk about what the Torah says in terms of character strengths. Basic question: does the Torah care more the Torah care about more than simply action? Does the Torah care? Does the Torah have 613 mandates on action? Is that all the Torah cares about? The answer is no. The Torah cares. The Torah cares much more about much more than simply actions. How do we see this? Examples. Where do we see the Torah cares about more than just what you do? Okay. So the Torah says, right, that the Torah talks about the notion of happiness. There's more than this, even, in fact. This is just examples, like Shmuel Aleph, where Shaul HaMelech does not kill Agag. He doesn't perform the action. He lets live all the livestock. Shmuel says, does Hashem really want your sacrifices? He wants your animals? He wants you to listen. Right? Meaning, I care more about your emotions than necessarily your actions, because that will lead to the right actions. Similarly, David HaMelech in Tehillim, this is Tehillim Nun Aleph, where David HaMelech is talking about his tshuva from the sin of Bathsheba, rather the chet of Bathsheba. He says at the very end, and famously, Zivche Elokim Ruach Nishmara, the sacrifices to God are a broken spirit. Lev Nishmara V'Nidkeh Elokim Loitziv Zeh. So ultimately, the pasuk sounds familiar. That's where we pull it from. Is David HaMelech? Is ultimately what is more important? More important than action is our emotional makeup. But emotional makeup doesn't necessarily mean characteristics, right? Meaning to say, it could just mean the Torah is mandating us not just to act, not just to speak, but to feel or not to feel, right? So how do we get to the next step? What is the difference between an emotion and a characteristic? As an example, an emotion and a characteristic. So spontaneous emotion is you're reacting to a situation. What's the characteristic? So it's innate. It's a trait, but ultimately it is, in a certain sense, it's the lens.
It's a predictor.
It is a predictor because it is, in a certain sense, it is your lens through which you view reality. So that means to say that if I have this lens and I am a particularly, let's say, humble person, no matter what the external stimuli are going to be doing to me, I'm going to be reacting in a particular humble way because that's my lens through which I see reality. So my emotions are going to be results of the lens that I have, which is my character. Right? This is the in terms of the way we're doing, which means to say that the way we change our emotions isn't necessarily by changing the way we're reacting, but the prism through which we're reacting in order to be able to get there. What's the word the Torah uses for that? What's the word the Torah uses for that? For character, characteristic? Midah. Okay, the way the Torah thought we call that is midah. What does midah literally mean, by the way?
Measure.
Measure. That's fascinating. We have to think about why it is that it's called a measure. Why would we call a characteristic a measure? Okay, so if maybe it's measuring the person. We're going to come back to this when we get to the Rambam and see what this is. This is the Rambam has a different word, actually. But a measure. It's interesting. Kabbalistically speaking, Rav Itamar Schwartz has a suggestion that the word midah, actually, the stam, when you say the word stam midah, default midah actually means an amo. Right? So when the Gemara uses the word midah, it generally means an amo. An amo is related to the word ima, right, which means mother. In a certain sense, it's the mother of our actions, right? Our midah, our basic, we'll call it the parent of our actions, the mother, birthing of all of our actions, comes from our midah, which is in a certain sense our prisms. This is the way we look at it. But now let's take a look at this over here for an example. Does the Torah care about our midah? Meaning the Torah cares about our emotions. It cares about the way we react to things or the way we don't react to things. Does it care about our midah? So the answer is absolutely yes. So here's an example. If we can get there. The Rambam says the following. This is the Rambam. Oh, actually, before we get to the Rambam, the Gemara says the following. Gemara Makos Dav Chav Dalet Amud Aleph says the following. Fascinating Gemara, very hard to understand. The Gemara tells us that how many mitzvahs do we have?
613.
That's pretty clear. However, the Gemara goes on to say, David HaMelech says he established them on 11. There are 11 mitzvahs. What are they? Quoting Mizmor and Tehillim, Tesvav. If we read, this is in the entire Mizmor itself is, Mizmor David Hashem, Yagur Ba'alecha, who's going to dwell in your tent, Mishkan Bahar Kochecha, who gets up to your mountain of holiness, a person who is Haleich Tamim, who walks in sort of, you know, innocence, Po'el Tzedek, acts in righteousness, Dover Emes, speaks truthfully, Bilvavai, Loi Raga Al-Lashara, doesn't speak Lashonara, Loi Asa L'Reyu Ra. So there's a whole list of, there's 11 characteristics listed in this Mizmor Tehillim. The Gemara says, what is David HaMelech doing? He's essentially, in a certain sense, condensing the Torah to these 11 characteristics. The Gemara goes on to continue to say further. Yeshayahu comes along, the midah al sheish, and Yeshayahu says not 11, 6. Quoting a pasuk which we did this last week in Nachyami, he says haleich tzarakos, the person who walks in righteousness, dover meishorim, speaks truthfully, ma'ase v'betza me'ashakos, avoids dishonesty, no'er kapov mitvoyach v'shochar, his hands are trembling from taking a bribe. Oitemos nami shmoa, not listening to blood. But oitemen omei rasparah, not to see bad things. Then the Gemara goes on. But micha b'midom al shosh. Micha comes along and says there's only three. What are these three things? Asos mishpat ba'as chesed utzat snei leches. Mishpat is justice, kindness, and hatznei leches. Humble walking. The Gemara continues to say that Yeshua established two, and finally Chabakuk came and said one, and that is tzadik be'emunos yichya, that a tzadik will live in their right in emuna, which is ultimately the root of it all. Now I don't know about you, this is a very strange Gemara. Think about it for a moment, right? Meaning this is not Reformed Judaism, folks. What is David HaMelech doing? This is what is Yeshua doing over here? There's 613 mitzvahs, and he says, "Don't worry, I got the shortcut. You just do these 11, you'll be all right." Does that really work?
He's saying everything will emanate. These are inner cores. If you can consolidate these,
okay, good. So
everything will emanate from
there's
them.
Different ways of looking at
you'll
this.
Behave,
the Sefer Arikar, Rav Yosef Albo says along a similar lines to what Dr. Yeager is saying. The Sefer Arikar is quoted by in the Maharsha, quotes a number of the opinions to try to understand this Gemara, and he basically says that these are not so much particular mitzvahs. In fact, some of these things aren't one of the 613 mitzvahs, just to be fair. Rather, what really these are the midos, these are the characteristics with which a person will be able to achieve the system. Now, you could look at this in two ways. You could say it in one of the two ways. You could say, if you are properly following the Torah system of 613, these will be the outcomes of that system, or these are the prerequisites necessary to be able to fully achieve the system. Right? We could go either way in that way. It sounds like these are the prerequisites, because Habakkuk's suggestion is the prerequisite for everything is emuna. And then everything else comes after that. But isn't it fascinating that the examples that Yeshayahu, for example, and David HaMelech in the 11 and 6 model were talking about were interactions between human beings, where the midos, in a certain sense, the characteristics with which we address the world. I want to add one point over here, which is so significant and really important in appreciating our system. That this, I've summarized this Gemara. I only quoted you the essentials. If you go to the middle of the Gemara, it goes through each of these characteristics of David HaMelech, each of these characteristics of Yeshayahu HaNavi, and it goes on to describe who exemplified each of these. So each of the 11 of David, it says, like Avram Avinu, like Rabbi Shmuel, like, and it goes on to describe different people who did this, exemplified each of these. And that's a really important thing in Judaism. We don't clear the playing field and start doing research. You know how we learn characteristics? We learn it through seeing it in action. We learn it through what we call shimush. Shimush means to say when you're around people who are worthy people, you see worthy actions. Rather than necessarily trying to suck it out of our thumbs or trying to recreate a new system, we see it when we see what godliness really is, what it means to be a real human being, what characteristics are exemplified. That's an important part of this Gemara. So I cut to the chase in terms of the establishment of the numbers and systems, but let's not forget the in-betweens, which is how we learn it. This is the statement number one. So the Gemara does talk about this. There is this notion, this is one example of many, where there's a certain sense of, we'll almost call it a container, sort of the outcome or the prerequisite necessary to get to the mitzvahs. But it's not so simple. There are many, many systems of midos. It's fascinating to me when you look at these videos, and I really advise you to take a look at some of the VIA character strengths videos. Some of them are produced by wonderful Jewish people, because Dr. Seligman's a Jewish person, you know. There's a lot of wonderful people who are doing this. And I'll talk about, you know, how we studied all these ancient cultures, and this all comes from, you know, ancient teachings, and there's pictures of Buddha, and there's pictures of Christianity and so on. Folks, we have it all. Let's stop trying to look across the horizons. It's been here, and it's much more sophisticated than we've ever imagined. We don't need to look over the horizons to see what we already have. So I want to give you a few examples of midos systems that we see. Examples as follows. The Gemara Rosh Hashanah tells us the following. We just said this literally this morning in the fast day. Vayavar Hashem alpano vayikra amar Rabbi Hashem passes over his face, Moshe's face, and says, vayikra amar Rabbi Yochanan ilmale mikra kasov iyashan amra. The Gemara says, if it weren't for the fact that the Pasuk told us this itself, I would never be able to say this. Malamed shenisatev HaKadosh Baruch Hu kishleach tzibor Hashem wrapped himself as if a leader of the community. Ve'erol ala Moshe seir tefillah and showed him how to daven. Omar kozman sheyisrael choytim yasu lufona keseder azev ani moichel lohem. Anytime they do this order, I will in fact atone for them. And what's this referring to? This is what you're referring to, your Gimel Midos. And of course, the word Midos should stand out over here. The Yud Midos HaRachamim. These are the attributes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's mercy. And there's 13 of them, which we talk about. So this is one system. Now, the funny thing about this system is, how exactly does that work? It's kind of, you know, B'nai Yisrael get to the brink of an abyss, and then they say, well, God, you know, we sinned, but we have this card we got when we landed on chance and community chest, and it says 13 attributes and you can save us now. How exactly does that work? So it's not so simple. The key to understanding this is actually the verb the Gemara uses. It doesn't say Yomru lefonai kaseder azeh. It says Yasu lefonai kaseder azeh. Do in front of me like this order. What does that mean then essentially? The only way we can really ultimately access God's rachamim is by doing it. So this is what, in fact, this is the basic premise of the Sefer called Tome Dvora. The Ramak, Rav Moshe Kor de Kor Devero, lived in the 1500s. One of the greats of Sfat, one of the great Kabbalists, who was a student of Arizal, who says the following. He says this is literally the first introductory paragraph to Sefer Tome Dvora. It's a very small Sefer, but the Pirushim abounds so much that the book is very thick because just the simple amount of Mefarshim on it. He says, "Adam roishi damelakon. A person should be like their creator. V'aziyeh b'soyat tzura la'elyon. That's when we look like our, we'll call it spiritual upper lofty form. Tzelem dumus she'ilu yedomu beguf avolei b'pulos. If we look like God only in our body, but not in the way we act, Harehu machziv hatzura. We are, in a certain sense, deceiving our form. That's a Kabbalistic term. We look like a human, but we're not acting like a human. Right? Then the angels will say, what a nice form, but doesn't act right. Right? Disgusting action. How do we express ourselves is not so much in who we are, but what we do. You know, Stephen Covey used to had a quotation. I can't hear what you're saying because your actions are shouting too loud. Right? We know situations in life like that. Right? What will help if you're not? There's no parity. Therefore, our goal in life is to exemplify God in 13 ways, like He is Rachum. Let me explain to you what that looks like. And so, the first parak of Tomer Devorah is spent saying, let's look at each of these 13 attributes. What does it look like Kabbalistically as God does it? What does it look like when a human does it? How am I supposed to express certain things? Zocher chastei avos. What does that mean? When I look at somebody else and they do something to me, how am I able to look at the virtue in that person by not looking at who they are but where they come from? Am I able to do that? And if I'm able to do that, then God looks down benevolently and says, well, human being, now you finally warranted your existence and I can now deal with you in a merciful way because you've set that tone in your lifestyle. So ultimately, the first system of midos, when we look at it, is the midos HaKadosh Baruch Hu has, which we are supposed to approximate. And by approximating, ultimately become godly. This is the first system of midos. There's another system of midos which we should be familiar with. The Rambam talks about this. The Rambam has 14 sections of a book called the Yad. Yad is Yud Dalet. It is 14 books of codification of all of Jewish law. In the first one called Hamada, he has one of the subsections of it is a book called Deos. Deos literally means knowledges or ideas. And in this is his word. The word Deos is the word he used to describe Midos. So he talks halachically speaking, what does it mean to have Deos, to have characteristics? And it's very worthwhile. It's really worthwhile. It's online. It's in English. The Rambam says very explicitly, Deos, this is the first halacha. Deos harbe yesh l'kol echad v'echad mim bnei adam. People have lots of different characteristics. V'zul mishun l'mizul v'rachoy kamim menu b'yosar. There are many different characteristics. Yesh adam shu baal chema. Koy es tamid. There's a person who's a very short fuse, always gets angry. V'yesh adam shadatim yusheves alav v'ena koy es klal. There are those who never get angry. It'll be once every while, it'll be very short. And he goes on to describe all the different characteristics we see around us. Then the Rambam says the following. He points out that the extremes when it comes to midos are bad. Too much of this or too much of that is bad. What is the solution? He says, Haderech hayashara hi amida habeinonis shevachol deyot v'deyot. Mikol hadeyot shirei shalad adam. The best way for a person to act is to be able to move in the center between the extremes of every characteristics. And the Rambam goes on to say that a person who has equilibrium, a person who has created an equilibrium in their own character in all these different spectrums is called a chacham, is called a wise person. A person who is able to adjust for their own inclinations just a little bit, so it's not epicenter, it's a little bit off, depending on the needs of themselves, is called a chassid. A person who's pious, because piety isn't going above and beyond, it is a greater fine-tuning of the piano, right? It means to say that the sounds that you make are perfect, not just in the way that regular pianos are tuned. That's the way that the Rambam suggests this over here. Let's come back to this for a moment. Let's look back at the word midah. What is the word midah again? Measure. According to the way the Rambam looks at it, the way the midos are, in a certain sense, are each set of midos are spectrums. The way we succeed in the midos is getting the right measure. Isn't that interesting? The measure between, so you know, a person who is frugal and a person who is a spender. Those are two extremes. So the Rambam says it's important to be a person who knows at the right time that is appropriate to spend and the right time that's not appropriate to spend. Don't be a person who every dime, nickel and dime, don't be the kind of person who's, you know, can't keep their wallet, can't keep anything in their wallet at any point in time. This is the Rambam's approach over here. So he's looking at it as systems of spectrums, essentially, right? The Rambam, what was that?
Except anger.
except anger, and he has examples, except anger and arrogance, which one should really move towards the opposite extreme. And he talks about self-correction. If you find yourself becoming a person who is, you know, who is very indulgent in the world and can't hold back, so you need to move to the opposite spectrum until you get back to the center. And the Rambam has a whole bit, a lot of descriptions over here. A lot of it sometimes is attributed to Aristotelian ideas, but nonetheless, the Rambam over here is talking about the golden mean, or what it means to fix ourselves. He's not talking about the Yud Gimel Midos. He's talking about what he calls Deos, the things we see in human beings around us. Right? And how we fix that and creating the equilibrium in that spectrum. There's another system. Just to appreciate this. You know, when we go through the Sira Sa'amir, there's 7 weeks or 7 days each. And at the end of each day, we talk about, you know, those different words, you know, chesed, shabbat chesed, chesed, shabbat gvura, chesed, shabbat tferes, right? We go through all of those. That's because there are what we call seven spheres. It's actually 10 spheres, right? These are 10 spheres, but the lowest seven are the ones that we deal with primarily. The top three are called Chabad, Chochmah, Bina, Vadas. We're going to sort of extract those for a second. But the bottom seven, essentially starting over here, right, at the bottom over here, is Chesed, Gvura, Tiferes, Netzach, Hoyed, Yesod, and Malchus. They move in triangles, right? So they're triangles, and of course these are actually mapped out on the human body. So you might have ever seen this structure as mapped out on the human body that actually relates to particular organs or particular parts of the body or energies, right? So Chesed, Gvura, Tiferes, right? These relate to different parts of the body and how it expresses its energy in this world. The example is that where do we actually learn this from? It's not just this wasn't just an invention later on, as some academics would suggest. In Divrei HaYomim, when David HaMelech is talking about the final building of Binyan Beis HaMikdash, he quotes a pasuk of the utmost gratitude to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we say it every time we take out the Torah. L'cho Hashem Agudulah VaGevurah VaTiferes VaNetzach VaHoyd Ki Cho Hashem Avaris L'cho Hashem Amalachah VaMisnasei L'chol LaRosh. Famous pasuk. In this are of course the seven attributes. Gedula is related to Chesed, and there's a reason why that's true. I'll come back to that in a moment. Gvura is so goes essentially Chesed Gvura Tiferes Netzach Hoyd Vashamayim Vaaretz refers to your side. There's a reason why that is a euphemism. And finally, Malacha is Malchus. So we have all the seven of these Siros actually in this pasuk itself. And the Baal Shem Tov says, this is a quotation of the Baal Shem Tov in Parshas Shmoy in Sefer Shmoyes. Shemati b'shem Rav Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov Zichro Livracha L'Chayal Haba. Roshi Advarim Vivanti Sha'odam Tsarif, Attakin Masa Liyashi Midoisov, Midoisa Kaneged Zayin Midos Tikudusha, Chokma, sorry, Kesagura Tverse, Nesaki Hojasoid Malchus, Hamirumazim Apostle Divrayami.
So the Baal Shem Tov says, our life goal is to make sure that our expression of these ideas is perfected. So as opposed to looking at the Yugimal Midos Arachim Akarish Baruch, as opposed to looking at the Deos as the Ram says, the Baal Shem Tov says, what's the system we're approximating? Is the internal system of by the way, there's Sfarim written in this. Shari Kedusha, Rav Chaim Vital talks about this. This is it. This is what our life is perfecting these characteristics. Correct, and of course that's why we have the Zayin Ushpizin, the seven Ushpizin. Each of them exemplified one of these characteristics in a different way, which is, by the way, why we go out of chronological order when we talk about the Ushpizin, because it goes in Kabbalistic order rather than chronological order of the way of how they were born. Another example of a system, a third system, a fourth system. This is just fascinating. This is Rav Shlomo Ibn Gabirol, who was one of the fascinating Rishonim, who wrote a number of Svarim, is well respected as a philosopher in the world at large. This is one of the charts he has in his book called Sefer Tikkun HaMidos, as an example. Fascinating. Look what he does here. Brilliant. Just brilliant. As Rabbi Talabam mentioned this when we did a historical Torah survey early on in the year on Rosh Hashanah Ibn Gabirol and this is one of the things I was mentioned. Fascinating. Look what he does here. He divides a person into quadrants, and of course at each corner of the quadrant is what he calls Dam and Avir. Then there is Mara Aduma and Esh. Then there is Mara Shchora and Afar. And there's Lecha, that is Halavona, and Mayim.
What is he doing over here?
These are the four humors, right? Not so humorous, but they are the four humors that was understood in medieval science, that ultimately a human being has. There's supposed to be an equilibrium between four different liquids, which is why they used to do bloodlet in those days. If you were sick, it must have been there was an imbalance, so just let some of it out and everything should be all right. And basically, there are four different humors that constitute a human being, and they were related to the four basic elements, which is fire, air, water, and earth, right? Those four elements ultimately are related to these humors, and he basically categorizes how the different midos fall into these four different quadrants. So, for example,
between Eish and Avir, between air and fire, for the midos of Gaiva, Azus, Achzarius, and Charitzus and Kaz. Meaning to say, if we look into our own character, the more ethereal, less earthly problems that we have to deal with are arrogance, you know, brazenness, cruelty, charitzus, which is alacrity, and anger. Those are, of course, right, sort of more ethereal things, as opposed to if we move to the bottom, which is habitachon, ha'anava. And so it means to say the more earthly ones should fall between Afar and Mayim. This is an example of how he divides it, which is, by the way, even though we've long ago left behind the four humors, right? If any doctor says you need a bloodlet, right? That's find the door, right? But nonetheless, we still, at the same time, we still adopt the notion of four quadrant, for the idea of these four elements. Just to be clear, I know that it sounds like it's backwards, but let's think about this for a second. These four elements in creation actually relate to solid, liquid, gas, and energy, which is the interface between those three states. Just to appreciate, there's a little more deeper than simply, oh, I just found four things in the backyard, right? Meaning to say that these things actually relate to the three states, the three phases of matter, and the interaction between all of them is energy, which is fire. So there's a lot to talk about over here, which is why actually in more modern-day Musa's Sforim, for instance, the Alei Shur, Rav Shlomo Volba, in the second Chelek, in page 147, he goes back to Rav Chaim Vital's model, which was adopted Rav Shlomo Ibn Gabirol, which is these ideas, Yisod HaEsh, Yisod HaRuach, Yisod HaMayim, Yisod HaAfar, and he talks about how the different characteristics fall as part of that. So for instance, in Yisod HaMayim, he talks about Chemda, Samamon, Avas, Nashim, and Kina, where it calls indulgence, Kina is jealousy, and Chemda, Samamon, and desire for money fall under, we'll call it Mayim. Mayim, of course, is the liquid flow, sort of like, just there's no sense of control or shape, it just flows in the shape of the container it's in. I see something, I want it, I want to put it in my mouth, I want it, right, that's kind of where those characteristics stem from, as opposed to, let's say, for instance, Ruach, where it is Chanefa, which is flattery, Sheker, falsehood, Lashon Hara, and his parus, and you know, self-importance, those kind
like
of
societal values today.
Right, so basically, if you look around in society today, so this actually is a section over here in the Alei Shur. This is practical work on Midos based on the system which was already talked about earlier. As another example, this is a system of four. We've looked at a system of 13, of 7, of 4. These are different systems. In more recent years, if anybody has the opportunity of ever learning, Rav Itamar Schwartz has a section which is called Bilvavi Mishkan Evne, a book called Bilvavi Mishkan Evne, and he has a number of svarim. They are incredible svarim about the, in a certain sense, the science, the Jewish science of building midos. And he talks about it. He talks about how there is external sets of midos, internal sets of midos, and bodily sets of midos, and how we line those up. It's really worthwhile. There is a website in which he has a number of his shirim in Hebrew, and the transliteration of them is the transcription of them in English. Is available. I'm not going to go through it now, but be as it may, he tries to synthesize these different systems and to show you how the different parts work together. Very fascinating. It's a lot of avoda in and of itself. I want to end really today with the following, and that is the difference between the systems that we're talking about, between Torah and the psychology systems. The difference number one between these systems, between the systems, the fact that Judaism from time immemorial has been talking about tikkun amidos and fixing our characteristics and bettering ourselves and living happy lives. One of the basic differences is, why do we do it? Why do we do this? Why are we bettering ourselves? Why are we fixing our characteristics? Where does this start from? Did the Rambam make this up? Where did this come from? So the Rambam says explicitly, very simple. Basically, all of Hilchos Deos comes from one pasuk. Here's the Rambam says. But he says, we are supposed to go in these balanced ways, the best ways in life. Why? Because we're supposed to be going in his ways. Who's his ways? That's a capital H. Right? Kach lomdu beferush mitzuzu. Mahu nikra chanun, avatal heye chanun. Just as God is gracious, you should be gracious. Mahu nikra rachum, like he is merciful, avatal heye rachum. Mao nikro kodosh, afato heye kodosh. Mal derech zu karu ha'anevim lokel b'chol oisam ha'kinuyim. Erech ha'pai brachet tzadik v'yashar tamim gibor chazok ha'yedzohem. Says the Rambam, what are we doing when we're fixing our characteristics? We are ultimately becoming godly. It's not because I want to measure what well-being is and therefore how happy I am and how well-being matches GDP and how societies are measured in happiness based on surveys or certain segments of the population. That's not the goal.
The goal is, by doing this, we become godly. That's a very different goal. That's a very different starting point from necessarily the systems of characteristics that is being suggested and researched now and has been over the centuries. Point number one. Point number two, which I think is really fascinating, is the idea of Rav Shalom Noach Berezovsky, who is in the Siva Shalom, the previous Shlosonim Rebbe. He quotes the Pasuk in Tehillim, which we say every Shabbos in Pasuk in Zimra, which says the following: Sur mira va'aseh tov ba'kesh shalom v'radfeu. Avoid evil, search after good, and find peace and pursue it. Fascinating idea. He says like this: in our character sets, what we've been given or what we've been endowed with when we enter this world and we move through it, we've been given certain things we need to improve, to like excel in, and certain things we need to fix. That means to say that half of our life's mission is self-actualization. The other half of it is correction. That means to say that, let's say Joe is born and Joe is an anger problem, half of his life mission, or maybe even more than half of his life mission, might be controlling that anger issue more than becoming the great CEO he has to be. Do you see, those are very, very different attributes. For example, says the Nesiv of Shalom, that's why it says in Parashas Kisetze, which is where his article is, his commentary is, he says, Kisetze la milchama aloivecha. The Torah says, when you go out to the war against your enemy, the Torah, he says, is obviously not just referring to the wars and the times when Israel had an army and was going out, and that was a very minimal amount of Jewish history. The Torah is also talking to us as individuals and saying, Kisetze la milchama, when you're walking out into war against your enemy. And the Torah says, la milchama aloivecha, remember, it's your enemy. That means to say that it's not your friend's enemy, it's no one else's enemy. You need to work out that dark corner in your personality and work out what it is that you need to be working on in life and understand that that's your goal. That's your characteristic that you need to address. That is your sur meira in yourself before you get to the aseh tov in your life. Why is this so important? It's because when you look at, let's say, for instance, as an example, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? So what's at the top of the totem pole? What's at the top of the pyramid of Maslow? Is
self-actualization,
right? Spontaneity, morality, creativity, problem solving, all these wonderful things. And that's society. That's meaning, what is a successful society? A society which has self-actualization isn't working just on bare basics. That's great, but that's only half of the equation, right? If I'm spending my entire life and all I'm trying to do is I'm trying to feel how I actualize myself, well, that's great. And you're supposed to be trying to find out what you're good at and using that and find the nexus between your skills and between opportunities and utilizing them and developing. Fantastic. But half of the equation is sumera. Our life mission might have been we've been endowed with a neshama which required certain tikkunim. It means to say controlling certain things. And this is, I think, an important point that when we're looking at the characteristics, we sometimes miss. That it's not just about the character strengths, but it's also not the top five on the list, but it's also the bottom five on the list. And trying to work out, what do we do with those bottom five? Are we able to change them? And how do we change them? It's not simple. Rabbi Yisrael Salanta used to say that it is easier to learn all of Shas than to change one characteristic. It's a lot of work. It takes a lot of pounding. But it is possible. It is possible to get there. So with this basic introduction, what I'd like to suggest is our road ahead is the following. Having said this, and having put this into context in terms of a much longer tradition of Judaism, I would like to still look at these six virtues and look at the research which has been done in the last 20 years on these virtues and the statistical research and show how a lot of it actually approximates what the Torah has been talking about beforehand. So what we're going to do is we're going to plumb the depths of history of these different midos and then also see how it's expressing itself in society today based on research and see how the two sometimes converge and sometimes actually move away from each other. So we're going to use this as a framework, these six ideas in the next 6 weeks, to start learning about these ideas in greater coherence and in greater definition, God willing, putting the two together. So this is what we have to look forward to. I hope it's a meaningful fast, and thank you for making the time despite a difficult fast this morning.